On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
There is an oft-repeated quote that those who do not study history are condemned to repeat it. It seems to many of us that the leaders in Washington, D.C. apparently did not attend the history classes at those very nice universities that they attended before they got elected to political office. Or if they did, they didn't take notes, because there's an awful lot they could have learned by studying not only American history, but the history of the civilizations that came before us. Oftentimes, when we talk about the Roman Empire, we tend to think of that as being that which was in place at the time that Christ was born, and that fell when Rome was run over by the barbarians 400 years later. But as it turns out, the people of that era did not think that the Roman Empire ended at that. And that's why our guest today is so very special. We're welcoming Robert Spencer, who is director of Jihad Watch and a Shilman Fellow at the David Horowitz Freedom Center, the author of 27 books, including the New York Times bestsellers The Politically Incorrect Guide to Islam and the Crusades, and The Truth About Muhammad, Founder of the World's Most Intolerant Religion, as well as the best-selling The History of Jihad, From Muhammad to ISIS, and The Critical Quran, Explained from Key Islamic Commentaries and Contemporary Historical Research. His most recent book was The Sumpter Gamut, How the Left is Trying to Foment a Civil War. His newest that we're going to talk about today is Empire of God, How the Byzantines Save Civilization. It's from Bombardier Publishing. Robert has also led seminars on Islam and Jihad for the FBI, the U.S. Central Command, the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College, U.S. Army's Asymmetric Warfare Group, the Joint Terrorism Task Force, the Justice Department's Anti-Terrorism Advisory Council, and the U.S. Intelligence Community. And it's our great pleasure and privilege to welcome Robert Spencer today to On the Bookshelf.
Great to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Well, it's long overdue. I've been meaning to get a chance to visit with you for some time now, and this is the first time we've had a chance to do that, and I'm delighted at that. I was fascinated by, I have read a lot about the Byzantine culture. I've read a lot of books about history in general, about European history, about military history, and I never realized that the term Byzantine or Byzantium was not particularly applied to the Eastern Empire in the lifetime of the people that were living it, that it was considered the Roman Empire, with Constantinople as the grandest city of the empire, all the way up until the fall of it to the Muslims in the 15th century. And that was really kind of a surprise to me, because out of all the books I've ever read, they invariably treated as though the Byzantine Empire was what it was known by the people that lived in it. But that's not the case, right?
That's absolutely right. It was not until 100 years or more after the empire fell that people started to refer to it as the Byzantine Empire. They saw that there was some need, or they felt some need, to distinguish it from the earlier Roman Empire that we all know, you know, Julius Caesar and all that. And I suppose that's reasonable in some ways, but the people who actually lived in it never thought they were anything but Romans, and that's the only thing they ever called themselves.
That's interesting, because even later on, they began to speak Greek instead of Latin, but still thought of themselves as Romans, and I find that fascinating. Most people who know a little bit about European history have heard of the Roman Empire. They might have even heard of the Byzantine Empire, but they really weren't sure exactly what that involved, other than Constantinople and then eventually the Crusades. There's an enormous amount of history that takes place. How long was there, if you include what we have been calling the Byzantine Empire and the early Roman Empire and the Roman Republic that preceded it and the kingdom that preceded that, how long was there a Roman government around the Mediterranean?
2,000 years, from 753 BC, when Rome first became a city, to 1453 AD, when the city of Constantinople, the new Rome, which was the capital of the Roman Empire and really pretty much all that was left of it by that time, finally was taken over by the jihadis. But all the time in between there was a Roman Empire, and the influence that it has had on America is incalculable, but most Americans are not aware of it at all.
We tend to be as a baby country, kind of unconcerned about much of what came before even the colonization of America. I have the great privilege of teaching in a school of journalism at the local university, Troy University, and as our regular listeners know. And I am constantly surprised about how little most of my incoming students know about American history. The Spanish-American War, for example, the Civil War, the First World War, even the Second World War. When you mention things that occurred before the United States, most of them are almost surprised, like, you mean people were alive then. The only people who are not surprised at are the international students, many of whom come from cultures that are much older than us, and they kind of look bemused when I try to explain to our own people, hey, there's a lot of stuff that's gone on before we got here. Is this just because there's so much history to tell that they don't tell enough of it, or they don't really emphasize the things that we gained from this 2,000 years of worth of Roman law and so forth?
Yeah, really, the way that history is taught these days is a disgrace. There's basically no world history taught, and so it's not surprising that you would encounter young people who don't really have any idea of what came before the United States. And then when they talk about the United States, it's all about how the founding fathers were racist slave owners, and that's about all that they learn about them. And so they end up with no respect, no regard for our own culture, heritage, and traditions. And so it's no wonder that they are so readily susceptible to appeals to throw them away. And that's one of the reasons why I wrote the book, actually, to try to teach people, show people that there is a great deal that we can learn from history, both positive and negative, things to avoid, things to do, and that we need to know these things, particularly in the West now when they're so challenged. It is imperative that we recover a sense of who we have been, where we've been, who our ancestors were, and what they can tell us now.
The significance of the Roman rule of law, I think, cannot be overstated. Very foundation of what we saw, at least for a very long time, as the rule of law in America, which was intended to be pretty much unilateral, and yet did not seem to get bogged down in the kind of details that we seem to be getting bogged down in, particularly lately. Tell us a little bit about why Roman law is so important for us to understand.
Well, for one thing, John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, when they were putting together United States law, including but not limited to the Constitution, they were very much influenced by Justinian, the great Roman emperor of the 6th century, who codified the laws for the empire up to that time, and his legal code became the basis for Roman law right up to the end of the empire in the 15th century. So it's nearly 1,000 years. And then you have Adams and Jefferson reading what he wrote and being deeply influenced by Roman law in formulating American law. And so we don't just learn from that, oh, this is some place that we have come from, and these are people we should be aware of to thank them for what we have. But we can also understand more deeply the reasons for our own laws and some of the reasons why things have gone so haywire in America lately because of legal fads that depart from the settled law that's been for millennia, really, as you can see, going back to Justinian.
In the Eastern Empire, Constantinople is built in the 4th century by Constantine as he promotes Christianity within the Roman Empire, which is the first time that the Christians have not been living in danger. There was not a constant amount of harassment and persecution for 300 and something years up to that time, but it could always happen. And in random places, even if it wasn't a empire-wide thing, there was persecution for the Christians. Now they're a protected minority, at least, and pretty soon will become the predominant religion of the empire. The part of the Roman Empire that is based in Constantinople, the eastern side, this lasts another millennia. But people don't know very much about that. Even is that because of books like The Fall and the Role, the Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire, that were very influential and at one point in among American scholars, that they just don't think of the Eastern Empire as being Roman, as you had mentioned before, and therefore not worthy of studying?
Oh, very much so, yeah. As a matter of fact, this is one of the main points of the book, that the East and the West split over theological issues, what we think of today as the Roman Catholic Church and the Eastern Orthodox Church, and they did not see each other as part of a larger whole, and that was ultimately crippling to the West in general, that especially in the later years of the empire, it may have been saved and could have continued if it had gotten more help from the West, but that help from the West was always contingent upon it adopting the West's theology, which it didn't want to do. And so the difficulty that people have nowadays is that they lack any sense of their own culture and their own heritage, as I was saying, and that goes with a feeling that there's not really anything worth defending. And when we are faced with so many internal and external enemies, it's a very dangerous perspective to have. The empire shows that in the disunity hamstringing its ability to deal with its enemies. At the same time, it also has to be said that the Byzantines stood between Europe and the forces of jihad for nearly 800 years, and that if they had not done that, then probably Western Europe and Western civilization as we know it would not have survived to this day, and you and I would not be having this conversation.
I think some of the most important events in this 1,000 years of the Eastern Empire, it probably would be wise for us to discuss some of those. One of the things that you just alluded to, the Great Schism, which it seems like it's a random thing, like the only reason that the Orthodox, with the big O, didn't want to follow the Westerners, the Romans in Rome, is that the Pope says, I'm the head guy, and whatever I say has to be believed, and you are subservient to me, and they didn't want to do that. And there was a certain truth to that, but that was certainly not the only reason that they were in such important disagreement with each other.
No, it wasn't the only reason by any means, but it was sort of the key point, the flash point that made it all happen, the split. There were basic theological differences in outlook, and ultimately, of course, it was also cultural that Constantinople was vying with the old Rome, as it was called, for the status of being the key city in the empire, and being the key city in the church was tied up with that inseparably, really, because it was a Christian empire. And so that ultimately led to the split and a lot of mutual misunderstanding, as I show in the book, on both sides, ultimately with tragic consequences. I think nowadays we also, likewise, should be allying with countries that are facing the same threat that we faced on 9/11, that we continue to face in terms of Islamic Jihad, but this is not something that anybody is even considering or thinking about in terms of the larger implications of the fact that we are all facing the same threat.
And of course that would mean, interestingly enough, that because one of those important events that occurred that was directly tied into the significance of the Eastern Roman Empire was the Christianization of the Kievan Rus, the origin of Russia as an Orthodox nation.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that that happened just about 75 years before the conversion, that is, of the Tsar to Orthodox Christianity came before the Great Schism. And yet there was already so much estrangement between the two camps that I actually quote in the book people, the Russians saying that they are most emphatically not entering into the faith of the Church of Rome, but of the Church of Constantinople. And if that had not been, if that split had not been there, then it might not be that Russia and the West would be estranged today. But it all comes from that, with geopolitical consequences really that are immense in all kinds of areas of history and politics. And even now, the antagonism between NATO and Russia and the United States and Russia over Ukraine, you got to wonder if the church had not split and the estrangement had not grown between the two understandings of Christianity, then maybe these other estrangements would not have developed either.
One thing people never mention in the Russia versus Ukraine ongoing fight amongst themselves, which has been actually going on for over 200 years, is that the Kievan Rus felt that was the heart and the origin of the Russian nation, as well as eventually the Russian Empire and the Soviet Union, that that Kiev is the place where it was first official that this land would be Christian, and that's an important part of the emotional understanding of Russia and their relationship with Ukraine. And people in the West, that is to say us, really don't seem to know about it or care about it.
Yeah, but Putin does. And, you know, and Putin, when he declared war, he was appealing at the same time to the Ukrainians, saying, look, we're really all one country. We fought together in World War II. We had the same culture. We had the same history, and so on. And so that is an appeal that is based on genuine historical realities. And as you say, Americans, for the most part, have no idea. Even State Department officials who are formulating policy to deal with Russia and Ukraine, they don't have any idea of any of this.
Another significant part of the discussion of the Byzantine Empire and the Eastern Empire of Rome is the rise of Islam. And this, it becomes, even though there had been foes that they had been fighting through the years, barbarians and so forth, Islam becomes the most significant foe consistently. And yet, from time to time, various emperors decided to make treaties with Muslims rather than trust the Christians from the western half of the empire, or from the western side of what became the Holy Roman Empire. This is not only tragic, but horribly ironic.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that you say ironic, because, well, I think that's understated. You know, it's just astonishing to me that even to this day, so many hundreds of years later, the Western leaders are still behaving in exactly the same way, with the same short-sightedness, the same refusal to see what the ultimate goal of the Islamic jihadis really is, and consequently, they continue to enter into agreements. I mean, even now, right now, we see with Israel on October 7th that Hamas commits this massacre, and immediately the Biden administration starts to pressure Israel to agree to a ceasefire. And a ceasefire would only allow the jihadis to regroup such that they could fight again more effectively later on. Now, that is something that we see in Roman Byzantine history over and over again, that they want a pause, they want a truce, they want peace, they want what we would call the two-state solution. All these things have been in history before, and they failed before, and they would fail again today.
It's amazing to me that if you read the Quran, it's all laid out there. It's okay to lie to infidels, which the father of Palestinian statehood, Yasser Arafat, did with impunity, because he was the one that said, "Oh yeah, we can peacefully subsist." But then he turns to his Muslim brethren and says, "Don't worry, I'm just saying this in English so these foolish people will believe me. But you and I both know what's going to happen." I challenged my students when they were talking about the protests on major campuses in the Northeast in favor of Hamas. And I said, what does that mean from the river to the shore? I said, do you have any idea what that means? Nah, nobody knew what it meant. Even the ones who weren't supporting Hamas still didn't know what it meant. And I said, let's look at a map of Israel. And they went,
not surprised.
Oh, and I thought, it's not that hard. You can Google Israel. Everybody in America carries a computer in their hand so they could Google Israel. How could nobody have thought to check? And these are the smart guys. You know, these are the ones that are going to college. So I guess we really shouldn't hold the people in Washington to much higher standard than that, because I'm not sure that some of them could actually use Google. But it's scary, isn't it, that we've been getting this, oh, they're really nice, we can trust them. We're more worried about Islamophobia than we are about, you know, jihad over the last 22 years. And yet...
it's amazing, yeah.
Opportunities that you have in the books you've written, I know it must get frustrating. You keep saying what's obvious and nobody pays attention, or at least few people seem to pay attention. And I noticed some very clever parallels to modern day ruling that you brought out in the book, Empire of God, How the Byzantines Saved Civilization. I appreciated those. The Crusades need to be mentioned, even though we could talk 30 minutes on the Crusades and what that meant for Constantinople. This was not Christendom's finest hour. Most of the emperors of the Eastern Empire feared the influx of the help from the West, and this was a wise thing.
Yeah, absolutely. The Emperor Alexios Komnenos, he had actually appealed to the West for help after the disastrous defeat of the Roman forces at Manzikert in what is today Eastern Turkey in 1071, and then the Turks started to advance in Asia Minor, and he asked the Pope for help. And the Pope was altogether happy to oblige, but unfortunately, when the Crusaders came, they had their own ideas of who was going to rule the land and whether they would give it back to the Romans or whether it would be ruled by the Crusaders themselves. And so the Crusades became an imperialistic enterprise against the Roman Empire, which probably here again would not have happened if they had considered the Romans to be of the same faith. But they thought, even though they were all Christians, they thought of them as these alien schismatics, and thus they were right, they were justified in taking their land. And this led to the weakening of the Crusades to a degree that the jihadis were able to overwhelm the Crusader holdings by 1291. Now, that probably did very much slow, if not stop, the conquest of Europe by Islam. And so here again, we come to a civilization-saving moment. But it was unfortunately once again rendered not as effective or powerful as it could have been by the disunity among the forces of the West.
I know that our time is almost over, and there's still plenty that we could be discussing. Is there anything in particular that we need to remember from this empire that we so seldom think about, and the way that the people of this era held off Islam until the Mongols could come along and kind of pummel them in the 13th century, that we can take to our own understanding of how things work in the world. I love it toward the end of the book you talk about everybody's got an established religion. Even states that don't have one have a certain set of values, and therefore we should not worry so much about that. What we should worry about is having no values, and that's pretty much what happens if we throw away our Christian origin without and replace it just with whatever people want to do is okay, as long as whoever's in office gets to decide what's okay.
Yeah, and that's what you have with the Biden administration. You have active incentives. You have the glorification of what everybody in throughout human history, in every culture, in every age, would have called depravity and perversion. And so that's exalted in the name of freedom, all sorts of things perpetrated under that rubric. But it's interesting to note that the Byzantine Empire, they actually did the opposite. they actually try to incentivize making people better, like paying prostitutes to give it up and giving them a good living that they could pursue without engaging in prostitution and things like that. Nowadays, it seems as if the government does just the opposite.
Is there anything else in the few minutes remaining that you would hope that I would get around to asking you that I did not?
I think that there are a number of lessons that can be learned for today from the Byzantine Empire. Another one is the stability of the economy. The money in the Byzantine Empire actually had the same value for 700 years. Now imagine if the dollar were worth exactly the same today that it was worth in 1323. There would be no inflation. There would be economic stability that Americans can't even imagine.
I think that the study of what has been called historically, or at least over the last century or so, the Byzantine Empire, the eastern part of the Roman Empire that kept it going for 1,000 years after the fall of Rome, is absolutely fascinating and absolutely essential. And did they all have brilliant people? No, there were a lot of pretty poor emperors, but even through all of that, it was a place with incredible architecture, understanding for the significance of having walls to protect the residents, a code of law that was constantly being simplified rather than complicated, and a way of getting rid of people that were bad emperors and not just putting up with them because they looked nice on social media or something. I think there's an awful lot that we can learn from them. And there's so much more in your book. We honestly could spend at least another hour talking about it. So, Robert, thank you very much. Available where books are sold and online everywhere, I'm hoping?
Oh, yes, indeed. Absolutely. Amazon, Barnes & Noble, wherever there's still bookstores.
Excellent. Excellent. The book, Empire of God, How the Byzantines Saved Civilization, from Robert Spencer and Bombardier Books. Robert, it's a great pleasure. I want to do this again real soon, okay?
Great. Yeah, call me anytime.
Excellent. Will do. And thank you for what you're doing to try to shake people into a little awareness about what we're really facing in this country.
Much appreciated.
Absolutely. And we will talk again.
Fantastic. I look forward to it.
All right. Thanks so much. Our thanks once again to Robert Spencer, the author of Empire of God, How the Byzantines Saved Civilization, from Bombardier Books. You can also find Robert Spencer online, on Twitter, and on Facebook. He is once again director of Jihad Watch and a Shilman Fellow at the David Horowitz Freedom Center. Look for my podcast, if you will, on thebookshelf.podbean.com. And listen again to your favorite radio station. Thanks for joining us. Until next time, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby, and God bless.